Chapter 12, Neutral Voices. "Where's the red one? Who can tell me where it is for 60? The operator of an illegal street hustle known as Three-Card Monty tries to engage someone in the crowd, but none of the midtown Manhattan pedestrians who stop to watch the action responds. "Here," he says, turning over the card that everyone knew was the red one. "Watch it now." He turns the card face down again and slowly interchanges it with the other two cards on his makeshift table, fashioned from a couple of discarded cardboard boxes. "Where is it now? Tell me for 60, he says, peeling off 3 20s from a wad of bills. "Who saw it? Anybody? You. Do you know where it is?" he asks a man in the crowd. The man hesitates. "Just point to it. Just point to it. For free. Go ahead," urges the dealer, trying to hook the mark. The man points to a card. There is little doubt that it is the red one, because the dealer, openly frustrated with the crowd's reticence, had moved the cards at baby speed this time, just to get people to start playing the game. "Show me 60 and you're a winner," says the dealer to the man, offering him the opportunity to fill in the skipped step of betting by simply displaying the $60 that he would have bet. The man need not actually hand over the money, because the winner always gets his bet back anyway, along with his winnings. The game's rules, it seems, are bigger than both the dealer and the player, and so the dealer must ask the player to at least go through the motions of placing a bet. "Show me 60, repeats the dealer, in a tone of someone obliged to walk a beginner through the steps of the game. "Show it to him, show it to him," advise two knowledgeable-sounding people in the crowd in excited whispers, encouraging the mark to seize the opportunity and win $60. The mark is a bit bewildered. Everything seems to be happening so fast, but he tries to appear like he knows what he's doing. He pulls out his wallet, removes $60, and shows it to the dealer. The dealer reaches out to receive the money, as if it were being handed to him, but the mark hesitates. "I have to hold it," says the dealer. The mark doesn't want to disrupt things now that he's just moments away from collecting his winnings. With his mind on the $60 that he's going to get, he decides to view the dealer's request as just another rule. It's only for a few seconds anyway, he thinks, as he hands his $60 to the dealer. "Turn over the red one," invites the dealer, gesturing toward the cards. The mark slides the red card to the edge of the table and flips it face up. But wait a minute. It's black. "Ah, damn!" yell the mark's two self-appointed advisors, showing sympathy, but in the process implying that this is a legitimate outcome. Stunned and disoriented, the mark is struggling to figure out what's been going on. "You took my money," he says quietly, apparently thinking out loud. And then with greater confidence, "You took my money." "A bet's a bet," the dealer starts to explain. "You took my money, give it back," interrupts the stung mark, who now appears to be on the verge of using force. A heated exchange of words ensues, and there seems to be no way that one man or the other can prevail through talk alone. Then someone in the crowd says, "You lost, man." These words seem to work a kind of magic on the mark, who suddenly appears to have lost full confidence in his own position. For the first time, he allows himself to consider accepting the situation as it stands, perhaps by viewing it as the words from the crowd suggest, as his loss of a fair game, rather than as his victimization by the dealer. The same words, "You lost, man," had they come from the dealer himself, might have been further provocation, but coming from a nonpartisan, neutral, disinterested source, they are persuasive. To finish cooling out the mark, the dealer offers a consolation prize that actually has some value, but he links this offer explicitly to the mark getting on with his day. "I'll give you a free chance to win 20, so you can have a nice day," says the dealer. The mark, no longer making any demands, watches the dealer deploy the cards and interchange them a few times. At the dealer's signal, the mark reaches out and turns over what should be the red card, but isn't. "Oh!" exclaim the two vocal people in the crowd. And the mark walks away, disappearing quickly into the busy pedestrian traffic. The dealer resumes his work immediately, giving himself the professional look of a casino employee who doesn't stop to react emotionally to the outcome of the game. But before he can hook another mark, a lookout stationed up the block spots a cop and motions back to the table. In an instant, the dealer is a pedestrian, floating inconspicuously down the street. The boxes and cards that he has abandoned suddenly look like ordinary trash left out on the sidewalk for collection, and the people in the crowd go on their way. But look, look who the dealer is walking with. You guessed it. It's the two people who advised the mark. In fact, they are the ones whose flamboyant winning and losing had attracted the crowd in the first place. They always won in a way that made you think, "That was easy, I could have done that," and lost in a way that made you think, "That was stupid, I could have won that one easily." And they are the ones who spoke up at the con game's three critical junctures, at the hook, encouraging the mark to go ahead and show 60, at the sting, saying "damn" at the black card, to frame the operation as a fair game rather than as trickery, and at the cool-out, encouraging the mark to view the outcome as his own failure by saying "you lost" instead of "he misled you." I witnessed this scene during my lunch hour one day and have tried to recount it here as accurately as possible. Yes, the streetwise hustler really did say, "so you can have a nice day." In fact, I've seen this game, a variation on the age-old shell game, many times on New York City sidewalks, and it's pretty much the same every time. I watch these games in part because the people who operate them often display impressive insight into the way people think and show great sophistication in their use of psychology. Surely their intuition and skill would make the typical professional psychologist look dull in comparison. Watching the shills is especially instructive. The dealer could certainly engage some marks without the shills' help, but he wouldn't survive for very long without their protection. It's easier to get a person to believe a false promise than it is to get the person to accept a loss. And when the game moves from the former stage to the latter, the operator's personal authority by itself is no longer sufficient to manipulate the mark. Thus, the operator has his neutral voices. For the operator of the game, getting the mark to go peacefully is a necessity, not an option, and so cooling out is not something that happens after the game. Cooling out is an integral part of the game. There are lessons here that go far beyond the game itself. In 1952, sociologist Irving Goffman wrote a paper in the journal Psychiatry showing that many institutions, authority figures, and ordinary individuals in legitimate society engage in activity that is essentially the same as that of the con artist cooling out the mark. In fact, as educational sociologist Burton R. Clark later showed, cooling out is one of the main social functions of institutions of higher education in the United States. The U.S. socioeconomic system, like the hustler, makes false promises, the principal one being that social mobility is available to all who work hard. By its very nature, a hierarchical system cannot possibly keep such a promise. The number of positions at successively higher levels decreases very quickly and is always less than the number of hard-working people who want the positions. This structure sets many ambitious workers on a collision course with the reality of limited opportunity. When they are finally hit with the tragic disappointment, they may become angry or resentful, and so the hierarchical system must engage in widespread cooling out. It does this not only to protect its agents who stand at the gate and do the dirty work of exclusion, but also to make sure that those who have been disappointed do not become opponents of the hierarchical system itself and enemies of its power elite. It is vital to the system that the losers serve the hierarchy respectfully and not sabotage it when they find themselves with jobs that have lower social status than the society of unlimited opportunity had led them to expect. Cooling out is therefore an integral part of the socioeconomic system. Those who say, "That's life," should understand that there is nothing natural about a system that kills the spirit of large numbers of people by first putting them in a position where they need opportunity, then promising them virtually unlimited opportunity, and finally making them losers. The hierarchical system itself does create much of the need for opportunity in the first place. Its hierarchical division of labor, in which the interesting and creative parts of work are separated out and reserved for a few, while the tedious and mind-dulling parts are heaped on the many, has a lot of people wishing for better jobs. And its hierarchy of authority, in which decision-making power is concentrated at the top, has a lot of people wishing for jobs where they have some say, or at the very least, insulation from those above them, autonomy. If jobs were designed in a way that did not force people to specialize in the uninspiring parts of work, and if decisions in the workplace were made democratically rather than by a hierarchy of bosses, two of the main goals that drive individuals to seek opportunity would already be met: more fulfilling work and a fair share of power. As the avenues for getting ahead in this country have narrowed, the route of formal education has become dominant, so that today the pursuit of opportunity in the United States is to a large extent institutionalized in the colleges. As a result, the colleges have become one of the pyramidal system's main tools for cooling out people's unrealistic career ambitions. They do it on a massive scale, yet by necessity conceal the fact that that is what they are doing. The process of cooling out students' high educational and career expectations begins, of course, long before college. Grades from high school teachers and advice from counselors have an effect, but it's easy to base your hopes and plans on the thought that these people are underestimating you. Their reactions to you have always been very subjective, after all, so perhaps their professional assessments, too, contain errors of judgment due to misimpressions, personality conflicts, personal prejudices, and so on. But then comes the big aptitude test. And a few weeks later, when you open the envelope and look at your scores, you feel like you are really looking at a true picture of yourself. The SAT and ACT scores have a powerful impact on the self-images of students, and those whose self-images are hit hard lower their expectations. They may not even apply to the colleges that they most want to attend. For most students, college itself means further cooling out. The lower the social status of the college, the greater its orientation toward wrapping up the formal education of its students. In fact, cooling out competes with remedial instruction to be the raison d'etre of the community or junior college. These two-year institutions, which take in 250,000 graduating high school seniors every year, allow large numbers of people to, quote, go to college and get it over with post-haste. Today, we're playing more of that winnowing function, says George Prather, an official in the 100,000-student Los Angeles Community College District. Nationwide, most students going from high school into two-year colleges plan to transfer to four-year colleges or universities where they can earn bachelor's degrees. In the end, however, a large majority of transfer program students either switch to a terminal program or leave college altogether. Each year, only about 5% of those enrolled in two-year colleges transfer to bachelor's-granting institutions. an astoundingly small fraction. For example, Los Angeles City College in the 1997-98 school year managed to transfer only 481 of its 15,000 students to the California State University system, and just 73 students to the more prestigious University of California system. Statewide, California's 106 community colleges, which constitute the largest system of higher education in the world, opened the year with 1,143,000 students. By the year's end, 56,000 had transferred to the California State University or University California systems, and 1,087,000 had not. Clark analyzed the process by which junior colleges change transfer students into terminal students. He considers, as an example, a student who wants to be an engineer, but who is not destined to be one. What might be the sequence of experiences that cools him out? At many junior colleges, these experiences start even before classes do, in the form of testing and counseling. Thus, after an enrollment examination in English and mathematics, our would-be engineer may find himself in remedial classes, which delay his eventual transfer to a four-year college, and more importantly, shake his self-image as a future engineer. At a required advising session, a counselor looks over his counseling folder, which contains transcripts from other schools, test scores, recommendations from teachers, and so on. Although his file is thin, the counselor observes that high school grades and test scores such as these usually suggest a less ambitious program. But of course, you're free to go ahead and try the pre-engineering program if you want. Just remember that we have a lot of really good vocational programs here too. The student will face this folder again and again as the months go by, and as grades and need for improvement notices from instructors accumulate. The file of impersonal, objective-looking data shadows him, and when it grows sufficiently strong, it will stalk him. The counselors, skilled in handling the overambitious student, use the growing file to justify becoming more persistent with their advice. Advice given at previous counseling sessions is in the student's folder and is now cited impersonally as part of the accumulating evidence. The counselors edge the student toward a vocational program, but they never countermand his choices, for the whole point of the protracted exercise is to avoid a personal hard no and have the student make the correct choice on his own. Finally, the student is put on academic probation for receiving below-average grades and must now submit to more than the usual amount of counseling. Students are allowed to stay on probation for a number of semesters or indefinitely, depending on the school. So probation does not force many students out of junior college. Rather, it is designed to get the student to think about himself and admit to his thinking the possibility of reclassifying himself as a terminal student. Reclassification would allow him to receive the college's two-year degree, Associate in Arts, by putting him in classes in which he would get grades high enough to bring his average up to the required level. He relents at last and reclassifies himself, marking a big change in his life. The college expedites changes of this sort by making them appear as small as possible. Our student will be an engineering aide instead of an engineer. There's a world of difference, of course, but on the surface things appear pretty much the same. He continues as a student, at least for the time being, and he tells his families that he has decided to start out as an engineering aide. The junior college's cooling out work, like all cooling out work, is necessarily hidden. When it isn't hidden, there is no cooling out. In fact, when attempts to cool out people become apparent, they backfire badly. seen as attempts at manipulation, they provoke anger and heat things up. The junior colleges, in spite of their actual function, are widely thought of as transfer stations for students on their way to bachelor's degrees. If these institutions were to get a reputation among high school students and their families as dead-end sidetracks for losers in the paper chase, many students would refuse to go to them. The pyramidal system, which uses formal education to allocate scarce opportunity, would have to find some other way of cooling out the excessive, quote-unquote, number of students who want bachelor's degrees. The four-year institutions themselves, with their dropout rate already at 50%, would be reluctant to help by increasing their share of the cooling out action. Many students who do get bachelor's degrees want to work toward a professional credential such as a law degree, medical degree, or PhD. As we have seen, the criteria that determine who is permitted to do this include attitude, and in particular favor individuals who have the kind of uncritical attitude or narrow focus that makes them easy to direct. But it is not enough for the qualification system to give the best positions to those who will do the best jobs from the point of view of employers. It must also cool out the high educational and career expectations of those who are excluded, including those who would do the best job from other points of view, such as that of clients and the public. Professional qualifying examinations help to do both. Not only do they help identify those who would serve employers best, but they also help cool out the, quote, failures. Failures are not a waste product of the educational system, but are carefully produced. At every level of the paper chase, those who don't get credentials are comparable in numbers to those who do, and so the losers cannot simply be given the brush off. The system must shut them out without turning them into enemies, because they are to become a large part of the workforce. To get them to work hard, if not enthusiastically, on jobs with lower than hoped for social status, and to get them to do so without having to give them more control over the content of the work and over the workplace, the system must make sure that those weeded out feel they have been treated fairly. Those who fail, just like those who pass, must feel well matched to their station in the social hierarchy of production, and an impersonal, objective-looking examination is a very persuasive matchmaker. A good example of such a matchmaker is the big qualifying examination that sends graduate students either on to the PhD or out of graduate school. Although the rest of this chapter focuses exclusively on the faculty-written professional qualifying examination, most of the discussion applies to qualifying examinations in general, including standardized pre-professional qualifying tests, such as the SAT and the ACT, and standardized professional qualifying tests, such as the LSAT, MCAT, and GRE. The examination's cooling out power, like the cooling out power of the voice in the crowd and the material in the counseling folder, comes from its nonpartisan image. The fact that the exam strongly favors particular values and attitudes must, like the affiliation of the shill and the socioeconomic goals of the junior college, remain hidden. The nature of the test must appear to be dictated purely by the subject itself, and not at all by consideration of the kind of obedience that employers want in a specialist. Students faced with dismissal will seize upon any point in the evaluation system that they find unfair. Clearly, the qualification system would not work very well if students saw the exam in part as a probe of their attitudes and values. If students perceived the political element, the test would be no more persuasive than a faculty member saying, "We don't like you." Accusations of bias would certainly follow, making a public issue of the system's notion of what kind of person makes the best professional, and forcing the educational institution to debate its notion openly, and in the process, to reveal not only its politics, but also, and more importantly, the very fact that it has politics. As it is, students generally do not perceive the political element, and therefore are led to confront themselves instead of the institution. The exam's squeaky clean image makes the crucial difference between the messy kicking out and the peaceful cooling out of those not wanted by the system. The test's nonpartisan look transforms it from a tool of the institution into an independent third party, allowing the institution to maintain a purely positive image. The institution is set up to produce successes. It is the test that forces denial. Modern personnel record keeping in general has the function of documenting for denial, notes Clark. When faculty members judge a student negatively and crush the student's hope of becoming a professional in the field, they use the test to distance themselves emotionally from what they are doing and to avoid feeling personally responsible for their decision. Yes, the faculty members write the test, administer it, score it, and report the results. But in doing each of these things, they see themselves as clerical workers, not as judges. It is the nonpartisan third party that judges the student. Faculty members are generally sympathetic, but detached, as the neutral third party snuffs out the student's aspirations in a clean, mechanical, businesslike way. Qualification systems almost always allow for repeated attempts at success and repeated occasion for failure. The student has the right to retake the qualifying examination even when the faculty doesn't encourage the student to do so. This right to try again is always presented in terms of the opportunity it provides, not in terms of its main purpose, which is to let down the hopes of the unwanted slowly, rather than in one abrupt, alienating, and potentially explosive step. When the students are failed for the first time, they begin to admit thoughts of revising their goals. By the time the exam comes around again, they are more prepared to accept its judgment of their ability to learn the tricks of the trade. The faculty is more persuasive this time, now that it is backed up by another piece of, quote, objective evidence. The facts get increasingly hard for the student to explain away. Students whose attitudes and values clash with those of the faculty are obviously at a disadvantage when the faculty meets after the examination and considers the whole student. But they are also at a disadvantage on the examination itself. These students come away from the test feeling frustrated. They feel that the test didn't give them an opportunity to show much of what they could do in the subject, but instead focused on a narrow range of skills. The test's focus within the subject, of course, is dictated not by the subject itself, but by the faculty's attitudes and values, and so these lie at the heart of the student's frustration with the test. However, most students who feel that the exam is underestimating them never manage to get to the heart of the problem. They grope for an understanding of why they failed, but end up offering explanations that they themselves don't find satisfactory. I didn't do my best work. The questions were unusually difficult. I ran out of time. I wasn't feeling well. Such explanations, which are the best that students can come up with when they don't question the neutrality of the test, do have a bit of credibility after the first test. You won't hear them after the second test, though. Even when students do figure out that attitudes and values play a key role in qualification, and even when they also feel that their own conflict of outlook with the faculty has tipped the balance against them, they hesitate to protest. There are two reasons for their timidity. First, they have no way to prove the conflict of outlook has made any difference. Second, trying to get ready for the all-encompassing examination has left them in a state of very low self-confidence. Because the test knows no bounds, the more students study for it, the more they discover they don't know. Students go into the marathon examination feeling unsure of themselves and come out of it ready to believe just about anything the faculty tells them about how well they did. The student who has failed, of course, suffers an even further reduction in self-confidence. Maybe I'm not really good enough, thinks the student. Maybe the faculty is right and I'm just making excuses. In the end, even the most perceptive students may be unable to speak out. Students who are willing and able to conform to the faculty's attitudes and values, which usually favor the status quo over social change, are less likely than others to get cooled out of professional training. They're also less likely to go on to challenge the field's role in the status quo or the status quo in the field. Among those who do get cooled out, individuals who would be uncompromising advocates for clients and the public, but a lot of trouble for employers, are overrepresented. This cleansing of the ranks is a great loss not only to the individuals involved, but to society as well. Indeed, the biggest losers in the game of professional qualification are not those shut out of professional careers, but working people in general, who are deprived of the allies they would have in the professional ranks if the politics of professional qualification were different.